Today I'll talk about local symmetry and square roots of gravity.
Supertranslations, a Hamiltonian study. So this is a bit mouthful, and after spending some time in the group here, I realized that maybe a better title for the talk would have been this: asymptotic symmetries of supergravity at spatial infinity. So how does this relate to the original title? Well, asymptotic meaning I will talk about DMS supertranslations. So there is not going to be any super rotations or the more interesting difference to W infinity story here. And local supersymmetry comes into the picture when we are dealing with supergravity theories. And at spatial infinity, when we study asymptotic symmetries, we usually do it in the ADM formulation or Hamiltonian formulation. So this is essentially a Hamiltonian study.
Do you think you could accommodate like this W plus one at all, like superposition and spatial?
I will comment on that later. But well, the hope is we can. But I don't know what would be a good candidate for that. All right. So the first question you may ask me is why I'm interested in supergravity. Well, supersymmetry, as we know, it is a special symmetry which converts a bosonic state into a fermionic state and a fermionic state into a bosonic state. So it's a nice way to convert bosonic and fermionic particles in a theory. And oftentimes, the upshot of adding supersymmetry to your theory is that the UV behavior is improved. Now, the underlying algebra of this symmetry is the following. We have, let me try this. Okay, we have the Poincaré part, which is P mu and J mu nu. On top of it, we have some fermionic symmetries. Now, remember, supersymmetry converts bosons to fermions and vice versa. So it must be a symmetry which is fermionic because it changes the spin of the states by half a unit. So we get a graded version of the Poincaré algebra, which is spanned by these generators. And the key idea is the following. So two supersymmetries anticommute to give us space-time translations. And effectively, so we get a parameter, translation parameter, which is built out of two supersymmetries, so epsilon 1, epsilon 2. So in this sense, supersymmetries may be thought of square roots of translations. Now, supergravity is a theory where you have spin 2, which is coupled to lower spin particles, and especially spin 3 half, because that's the supersymmetric partner of graviton. So if I act the supersymmetry operator on the graviton, I will get a spin 3 half, which is the gravity no field. Now, this is again a nice way to trying to unify gravity with the other forces, which are lower spin particles. And again, in supergravity theories, the UV behavior is much better than Einstein's gravity. For example, we have a maximal supergravity theory in 4D, which is called the N equals 8 theory. And it has been shown to be finite up to 4 loops, which is quite something. So this is essentially our key motivation to study supergravity and what would be the asymptotic algebra in supergravity theories. Now, let's talk about the algebra in supergravity theories. So we have, again, the same set of operators. We have P mu, J mu nu, and the fermionic ones. But now these are local. These are responsible for local supersymmetries. So we will get a diffeomorphism when we anticommute two supersymmetries. So this is, again, built out of two local supersymmetries. Now, in gravity, we know that when we approach asymptotic infinity, if we are looking at asymptotically flat spacetimes, the Poincaré group gets enhanced to BMS group, so which has the following structure. We have the Lorentz part, SO3, 1, and supertranslations. So now the idea is, can we also do something similar for super Poincaré, such that the fermionic symmetries also get enhanced to an infinite dimensional set, and they anticommute all of each of these fermionic supersymmetries will anticommute to give us supertranslations. Now, there are some works already at null infinity where such superalgebras have been constructed, and they have infinite dimensional fermionic symmetries. So this was also a key motivation for us to look for such structures at spatial infinity. So this is going to be the focus of my talk. So we are seeking some graded version, graded extension of the BMS algebra, at spatial infinity, which will have infinite dimensional fermionic symmetries, and such that we can generalize this bracket. So on the right hand side, we will have super translations instead of just the four space time translations. Okay, now this is a very brief outline of the talk. I'm going to start with some very basic idea of the PMS symmetry, because there are many experts in the audience already. Maybe I don't need to introduce the subject to you, but just to set up the stage, I will just highlight some key features of this PMS story. And then I'll move on to the Hamiltonian formulation of GR, because we want to discuss the asymptotic structure at spatial infinity. And I'll discuss how the PMS super translations are recovered at spatial infinity. And in the second half of the talk, I will discuss how we can add fermions to the mix and get some super algebra for these supergravity theories. Okay. So super VMS super translations. Now, we know in GR, we have this idea of a metric which encodes the geometry of space-time, and they satisfy the Einstein's equation, which can also be derived from a good action principle, which is the Einstein-Hilbert action. And the key idea of GR is that the theory of gravity is invariant under general coordinate transformation. So we are always allowed to do such diffeomorphisms, and these should be symmetries of the theory. So BMS symmetry is the following. For asymptotically flat spacetimes, at null infinity, when you ask the question, what are all the allowed transformations that will preserve the form of this metric at null infinity, you get a set of transformations which is much larger than the set of transformations in the bulk, which is Poincaré. So in the bulk, we have three rotations and three boosts. I'm always talking about four dimensions, so 3+1. Three rotations, three boosts, which is the Lorentz part, and four translations. So we have a 10-dimensional Poincaré group that we usually expect. But when we go to null infinity, it was observed that the Lorentz part remains the same, but you can see that the AMU, the four space-time translations, they are actually replaced by some function of some function on the celestial sphere. So if you will, in terms of spherical polar coordinates, this alpha depends on theta phi, or in terms of ZZ bar coordinates, this can be a function of Z and Z bar. So this way, we get an infinite dimensional algebra, which is Lorentz and super translations. But this was the very first idea of super of BMS symmetries. This is what was found in 1962. But later, this super translation was in fact further enhanced to include super rotations, diffs2, W infinity algebras, and a lot of rich algebraic structures. And it also gave rise to the idea of celestial holography. It has very nice connections to soft theorems, amplitudes, and so on. So this has truly become a subfield on its own. And you may see already that there are some people in the audience who are here, but I'm certainly missing out a lot of names. So this is the story of asymptotic symmetries at null infinity. And then later in 2014, there was another perspective to study asymptotic symmetries, which followed from this paper by Dhupal, Givens, and Hepavati, where they found that the BMS group is actually isomorphic to conformal chiral groups. And this gave rise to another revolution in the study of asymptotic symmetries, because we can now connect these nice, interesting, infinite dimensional algebras to Kerolian structures, Kerolian fluids. And we also now have a good candidate for some flat space holography picture, and so on. So this is a second approach to studying asymptotic symmetries. Then there is a third approach, which came much later in 2018, where we start with the ADM or Hamiltonian theory of gravity. And so it's based on the 3+1 formulation. And here we can canonically realize all the BMS charges, the super translations, from an action principle. And this is nice because, as we know, canonical realization is very important. It's often a precursor to any quantization methods that we might try. So my talk is going to be focused on the third approach, where so the starting point is going to be ADM action. So this is part one. So in the Hamiltonian formulation, what we do is we foliate the space-time using the space-like surfaces at a constant t. So our time is going like this. So you can imagine that there is a stack of bread slices, and each slice is a space-like hypersurface at a constant t. And since we are interested in asymptotic infinity, you could imagine that going to infinity would be like approaching the bread crust here. And since we are in four dimensions, our boundary of this space-like hypersurface is going to be a S2, a sphere. Now, on a particular space-like surface, we can define the dynamical variables Gij, which is the metric on this three-dimensional surface, and its conjugate momenta, pi ij. And we can write down a Hamiltonian action for gravity, which goes like this. So it has the usual p q dot minus h form. This is the kinetic term here. And this is the Hamiltonian density. Now, you will notice that in this ADM action, we have these Lagrange multipliers n and ni, the laps and shift functions. And the role of these Lagrange multipliers is to implement the constraints, the Hamiltonian constraint and the momentum constraint. And like in any Hamiltonian systems, these constraints generate gauge symmetries for us. And I'll show you what the generators actually look like in the next slide. But the idea is that we now have a good phase space in terms of Gij and pi ij. This is the symplectic form, and they have a nice Poisson bracket structure in it. And we can define the canonical generator of symmetries. So what do the diffeomorphisms look like on these variables? We have this transformation laws for Gij and pi ij. And the generator of all diffeomorphisms is given by the constraint, as I said before. And then you can have some surface integrals. And this is actually the crux of the matter for gravity in Hamiltonian formulation, because the value of this charge actually tells us which diffeomorphisms are gauge symmetries and which are true symmetries. What do I mean by that? So if for a certain vector field, psi, the charge is zero, that means that it doesn't affect the physical state. It is truly a gauge symmetry. It's a trivial diffeomorphism. I can quotient out with it. And this is what Hanno and Trossard, they called it proper gauge transformation. So we are always allowed to make these changes in our theory in order to make some calculations simpler or to make the charges look nice and so on. But if the charge for a certain vector field is non-zero, then these actually affect the physical state. So these are improper gauge transformations. And these are true symmetries of the theory, because these charges then are they are the Noether charges corresponding to that symmetry. So for as an example, we have the Poincaré symmetry. So if I evaluate this generator for these vector fields, I'm going to get some non-zero charges here. And these are usual Poincaré charges like ADM mass and angular momenta and so on. And these are true symmetries of the theory then. Now, the idea is the following. We know that the Hamiltonian action, the ADM action, with some standard boundary conditions give us good, well-defined Poincaré charges. Can we relax the boundary conditions in a very particular way, such that there is room for some more symmetries? And when we do this, we must go back and ensure that everything is finite, the kinetic term, the symplectic form, there are no divergences. And then we have to check that the symmetries that we had before, namely Poincaré, are still canonical. And then we can see what is the complete algebra of all the diffeomorphisms. And that will give us the asymptotic symmetry algebra. Now, okay. So the asymptotic conditions have several ingredients when we try to define them step by step at infinite, at spatial infinity. So we are going to use xa for the coordinates on the sphere. So This could be theta phi for spherical coordinates, but you can use your favorite ones, doesn't matter. And r is the radial direction. And remember, we are working on a constant time hypersurface. So our Poisson brackets are equal time Poisson brackets. So these are the three coordinates on this surface. And our asymptotic condition is that we are looking at asymptotically flat spacetimes. So you will notice that this is the Minkowski, the blue terms here are the Minkowski values for in terms of spherical polar coordinates. So this is the fall-off conditions we choose. And for the momenta, similarly, we have some fall-offs in terms of 1 over r. And so in my talk, this bar always mean functions on the unit sphere. So it has nothing to do with complex conjugation. OK. Now, the second ingredient is parity conditions on the leading terms. Why are parity conditions important? When, as I said before, the boundary in our case is a S2, it's the celestial sphere. And if we have some potentially divergent terms, but we can use the parity conditions to make them some odd functions, then the integral of odd functions on a sphere is zero. So the parity conditions are a very nice way to cure some divergences. And let me first focus on the black ones. So let's ignore the blue terms for now. This was the strict parity conditions proposed by Regen Teitelbaum in 1974. These led to a good action principle and well-defined Poincaré charges for gravity. Here you will notice that each term has a strict parity. It is either strictly even or strictly odd. Then in that case, you do have a good action principle, but you do not get BMS supertranslation. You only have Poincaré. Then in 2018, what Hanno and Trossard did was to relax these parity conditions, but in a very controlled manner. So we are allowing some, let's say here, we are allowing some odd part in this H bar AB, but it's not something arbitrary. It's in a precise form of a gauge transformation. So this gives us some control on these relaxed parity conditions. So maybe even if we have some potentially divergent contributions, we can kill them using some other gauge transformations or some parity choices. Now, the first thing is okay, because the kinetic term and Hamiltonian are still finite if we take these blue terms into account, so we are good. Now, we see that there are some divergent contributions to the Poincaré charges, but we can cure them by making sure that the constraints are imposed to a subleading order. So this can be fixed by putting stronger constraint, stronger fall-offs on the constraints. And then there is a fourth ingredient, which involves this radial angular component, HRA. But I will, yeah, please.
Oh, I just wanted to ask, is stronger with respect to Regen Teitelbaum?
Yes. Yeah, because usually you have, these constraints are in the at the bulk term of the Poincaré charges. So if you have some total derivatives, you can turn them into surface charges. And if the fall-off conditions are strong enough, they go to zero. But since we have relaxed them, unless we impose one order stronger fall-off condition for the constraints, we get some divergent contributions. So, okay. So I will tell you more about this fourth condition when we actually need it. So let's put it in the back burner. So now we also have to look at the fall-off of the parameters. Let's say for Poincaré, we can rewrite everything in spherical coordinates, and we see that the boost parameter goes like r, the rotations go like a constant, and so on. So the next step would be to check if these are still good symmetries, because that was the whole point of relaxing our boundary conditions. So let's check if we have spoiled the invariance in some way. Yes, please.
Here you talk about infinity and imposing parity to remove infinity, but let's say usually what we do when we're faced with infinity and taking this limit, whether it's in ADSE,
yeah,
with the covariant formalism, that we just look at the possibility of symplectic normalization. So there is usually this infinity are tied up with the fact that your symplectic potential doesn't have to be God given, and you have freedom into correcting it. Whereas in this approach, it seems like, this is not, there's no symplectic normalization at all involved. that may explain why people are not able to include the super rotations. Like,
exactly.
And I wonder why is it impossible to do symplectic colonization in Hamiltonian? Why people haven't really used this very kind of generic picture?
So yeah, that's a very good point. Thank you. So there are two points that I want to say. First of all, of course, it's not God-given, and we should be able to modify the symplectic action in a well-defined manner. And I will show an example, let's say for the fermions, that we do have to add some boundary terms to the symplectic action. And this way, we modify the symplectic form, and one can still define good charges. But to include super rotations, it seems that even doing that is not enough. I will comment on it maybe a bit later. But the idea is, in fact, to look for such a more relaxed notion of symplectic invariance, where we are allowed to add boundary terms or corner terms, which can give us some renormalized symplectic form. But so far, we have not been able to do that for super rotations or the other higher symmetries at spatial infinity. The other problem is that at null infinity, you have fluxes. So if you have some non-integrable pieces in the charges, one can interpret them as flux. But at spatial infinity, we don't have it. So
which is better. It's much better.
Yes, it is better in some way. But unless we have, so unless the invariance of a symplectic form fails, so if the invariance of a symplectic form fails up to a surface term, then it's good because we can add something to cancel it. But if it's something in the bulk and things are worse in that sense, then it seems that adding boundary terms is not going to help it. And this is what happens for super rotations, at least. So, but this is something that we are trying to understand. Maybe there is something more to it that one can do. But yeah, thank you. Thank you for the very important point. So, okay, maybe you have some time to look at it already. So the idea is that we will call something a symmetry if it's a canonical transformation on the phase space, such that we have the invariance of, strict invariance of the symplectic form. So we are, so it must be zero, not some surface term or some other contributions. So the a transformation of the symplectic form under a certain vector field psi has to be zero. And if this is the case, then we can associate a good canonical generator associate with this transformation. And when we check this for the Poincaré charges, it works well for space-time translations and rotations. So for example, in the case of rotation, we have we can prove that the symplectic form is invariant, so we have a good generator. But there is a problem with the boost generator, because when we try to check the symplectic invariance of the symplectic form with our relaxed boundary conditions, we see that we get something non-zero. So we have some extra terms which are not zero under the new parity conditions. And this is a problem, because then it means that we have relaxed the boundary conditions too much. So we are actually losing symmetries rather than getting new ones. So what is the resolution of this? It's a two-step resolution. First, we perform a gauge transformation. So it's like adding some new term here, which is a field-dependent gauge transformation. So you may have your own opinions about it. So using a field-dependent gauge transformation, we can kill a part of this, these terms. So the idea is to set this F to minus half H bar. So this is a field-dependent term. And then it gets rid of the first line. But we still have to take care of the second line. Now, recall lambda here is the leading term of HRA. So both these terms depend on lambda. So if I set this to zero, if I assume that HRA goes one order lower, it starts at 1 over R, then we are good. We can, again, restore the invariance under boost. And it has a well-defined canonical generator associated with it. So this way, we can recover all the Poincaré charges in case of gravity without adding any surface field, surface degree of freedom, in order to define canonical generators. I will come back to this point later, because in case of fermions, we see that we have to do something more. Because again, the problem is the same. It is usually the boost generators which diverge. It's the first thing to diverge because they go like PR. The parameter boost parameter goes like R. And in some cases, we do need a surface degree of freedom, and in other cases, we don't. So we don't have a clear understanding what is going on and if there is a pattern or not. And then we come to the key question that, okay, we have relaxed our boundary conditions. We have managed to find good canonical generators for the 10 Poincaré charges, but are there more symmetries now? Because that was the whole point of this exercise. And indeed, there are more symmetries, which are some diffeomorphisms, provided the parameters have certain parity. So the time component can only be an even function, and the spatial component can only be a derivative of an odd function. So together, we get one single arbitrary function worth of symmetries. Now, so this is just a way to rewrite the time component in even spherical harmonics and the spatial ones in odd spherical harmonics. So the blue terms here, T0 and omega 1, the lowest harmonics actually correspond to the four space-time translations. How do we see this? Well, let's say I have this function, theta phi. Now I've moved on to spherical coordinates. If I expand it in spherical harmonics, like so, so you'll notice this T's appear at the even harmonic orders, and the W's occur at the odd ones. So T0, so the lowest one only has one mode, T0, 0. And the second lowest, which is the L equals 1 case, there M can take values from -1 to 1. So that's three lowest spherical harmonics. So these correspond to spatial translations. So together, these four are account for the four ordinary supertranslations, four ordinary translations. And all the higher modes are now pure supertranslation. Now, we can define the canonical generator for all these diffeomorphisms. So this square bracket here is the boost charge. This is the rotation charge. And these two together give us the supertranslations, which corresponds to one function dependent parameter. And you'll notice that, so when T is the lowest mode, which is T00, it's a constant function. So this is actually the ADM energy, as we know, should be the case for a charge which is derived from the ADM action. And here we can clearly see the role of proper versus improper gauge transformations. So only the modes which are even for T and the modes which are odd for W have non-zero charges here. So these correspond to supertranslation. These are improper gauge transformations. These are true symmetries. And if I put something odd here or something even here, the charge is going to be zero because it's an odd integral on the function on the sphere. So these correspond to proper gauge transformations. So they are trivial. And then we can check the Poincaré bracket algebra like this, and we get VMS4 as a asymptotic symmetry for gravity. This is just how the parameters transform. So if you want to see BMS as an infinite dimensional enhancement of Poincaré, there is a nice way to do that. So if you split the Lorentz part of the charge and the supertranslation part of the charge, because then you can write this one single bracket into three. So the Lorentz with another Lorentz gives you, it closes on the Lorentz group. Then then you have, so here A and AI are the space-time translations. So under Lorentz, the space-time translations get rotated or boosted, and two translations, two P mu's commute. So effectively what we have done here is we have replaced this four-dimensional space-time translations with an infinite-dimensional super translation generator, but the structure of the group is still the same. So this is how one recovers BMS symmetry at spatial infinity, starting from the ADM action. But the standard boundary conditions have been relaxed with a gauge twist. Now I come to the second part of the talk. How am I doing with time?
Good. You have 5 minutes.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Now, for supergravity as well, we will use the Hamiltonian formulation. So let me be more precise here. I will only talk about n equals 1 supergravity, which means we have one set of one super multiplet, meaning I have spin 2 and spin 3 half field. So there are no vector fields or scalar fields or other complications that one might like to incorporate in the theories. Okay. But from here, we would like to use Fierbein formulation because it's easier to couple spinners to spin 2 when we have this local Lorentz symmetry to play with. So instead of working with Gij and Pij, we are going to work with the Fierbein's EIA and the corresponding conjugate momenta, which have this kind of definition. And the Hamiltonian action for this supergravity, the minimal supergravity theory, is actually well known from 1977, and it looks like this. So again, we have the kinetic terms. So this is for the gravity part. This is for spin 3 half, and the Hamiltonian density, which again looks like this. So just to remind you, these two constraints, these come from the theory of gravity. So this is the Hamiltonian and momentum constraint. Now we have an extra one, which is the fermionic constraint, S. And there is another one, JAB. This is to implement the local Lorentz symmetry, but we are going to fix it later. So this will not give us any non-trivial charges. But these three are the main important ones. Now, the role of this new fermionic constraint is again the same. This will generate gauge symmetries for us. But in this case, it's going to be a fermionic gauge symmetry. So this is really the local supersymmetry that we have in the theory. Now, our phase space variables are these Fierbein fields, the conjugate momenta, and the spin 3 half field, psi. And psi is self-conjugate to itself, so we don't need a conjugate momenta for that. But we have this transpose. And we can write down a symplectic form here. Okay, so let's ignore this term for now because this depends on the boundary conditions. Anyway, so let's try to see if we can get something infinite dimensional for the asymptotic symmetry algebra of supergravity with some relaxed boundary conditions. So this is our first attempt. Since I write attempt 1, that means that there is an attempt 2. So this will not going to, this is not going to give us the square roots of supertranslations. So in the first attempt, what we do is that we take the spin 2 fields with the gauge twisted parity conditions that I discussed in the previous part. And for spin 3 half, we have this kind of a fall off. So it goes like 1 over r squared. And it has no, so if it goes like 1 over r squared, then you don't need a parity condition on this field because the charges are, the divergent terms just go away. And the supersymmetry transformation looks like this. So you can see Gij goes into psi ij. So that's the boson going into a fermion. And on psi ij, the lowest order term, this is a gauge transformation. So it looks, it goes like derivative of this epsilon parameter, which is local now. And the fall off that was chosen for this kind of a spin 3 half fall off is like so. So epsilon naught plus 1 over r, where this epsilon naught is just a constant. So this is the fermionic gauge symmetry of the spin 3 half field. And yes?
Why epsilon 0 is a constant? I mean, can it be just a function on the coordinate on the two spheres?
We would like it to be, but this is exactly the point. Initially in this paper, so this was done by these people. So they started with a constant, with a spinner, which depends on the angles. But it turns out that if you want to define a canonical charge for the supersymmetry, then it must be a constant spinner such that it comes out of the integral and then the charges are well defined. So the point is, okay, let me give you the trick here. If you want to have something angle dependent here, you must also include some other term here, which falls off slower than 1 over r squared. And this is the attempt 2 that I'm going to talk about.
Ah, okay.
So if you start from this fall off, you can only have a constant spinner here. So you don't get an infinity of fermionics, supersymmetries.
Okay. And can I ask another question?
Yes, please.
So, sorry, you mentioned it en passant, but what JAB, do you set it to zero, the constraint?
Yes.
Okay.
Because we are going to fix the local Lorentz invariance in some ways.
So because you don't have matter multiplets and anything.
No.
Just the
yes, okay, exactly.
Thanks.
So at the end of the day, when I say this is our canonical charge, you can see there is no charge associated with JAB.
Okay, thanks.
It's just for our computational ease that we have this local Lorentz invariance, and we will set it to our convenience. Okay, so as I said, we have some canonical generator for this full supersymmetric Poincaré, super Poincaré algebra, and this is the charge associated with our spin 3/2 gauge symmetry, and the BMS. So here, this means we have all the charges here. So psi and psi I are for the bosonic gauge symmetries, which is Poincaré, BMS, because we use the relaxed boundary conditions. So these charges are the same as BMS. And the epsilon is for supersymmetry, which looks like this. And the algebra that we get here is very simple, actually. So we have the BMS part as before. Then we, if we commute one supersymmetry with one of these charges, so it will commute with P. So let me write it here. Probably so. Q with P mu is going to be zero, and Q with the rotations, it's going to rotate or boost the supersymmetry parameters. So this tells us that these generators, they transform as spinners under the Lorentz group, and then two supersymmetries give us the A0 and AI. So these are the four space-time translations. So we don't have, since it's a constant spinner, we don't have a infinity of fermionic generators. So we don't have any brackets where these two will give us T and W. So which is a bit sad, but this is what we get with these boundary conditions. Meanwhile, at null infinity, there was these very nice works where they do manage to find some infinite dimensional fermionic symmetries. So we thought, okay, let's try again. So we keep the same fall-off conditions for spin 2. For spin 3/2, we relax this part with, again, something which looks like a gauge transformation. So that is the key idea of these relaxing the parity conditions and so on. And now this chi field here, it's has a certain fall-off, and this the leading term is even under parity. And again, you can look at the supersymmetry transformations. And if you have this kind of a fall-off, then you're allowed to have an angle-dependent fermionic parameter. And so again, as the story goes, we have to check that these things are canonical. So because I have relaxed the fall-off conditions, there may be some new contributions to the charges, which may be divergent. So we have to go back and check that the kinetic term and the symplectic form is finite, the Poincaré charges are canonical, and then we can think about the asymptotic symmetry algebra. And again, we have a problem with the boost. So translations and Lorentz rotations are well behaved. There is no problem with their canonical realization. But with boost, we find something non-zero. And precisely, these terms go as chi naught, which is exactly how much I have relaxed the boundary conditions. And it turns out, no matter how much we try, we cannot kill them with gauge transformations. We cannot kill them with choosing certain parity conditions or something else. And we must introduce a boundary field, which we call omega, such that the boost transformation of omega will cancel these contributions. And this was the only way one can define a good canonical charge for boost. And this is, again, similar to what people do at null infinity. And this is very interesting because it means that the symplectic form in this case as well is not something very rigid. We can maybe change them by boundary contributions, but it's not very clear when we can do it or when we need to do it. It just seems like something ad hoc we do as and when required. Now, So we change the action by this kind of a term. So omega only appears as a boundary degree of freedom. And we have so extended the phase space with this omega field. And this comes with its own phase symmetry, meaning that if you look at this term, I am allowed to make a field redefinition or a change of variables on this omega, going to omega plus sigma, as long as sigma doesn't depend on time, because we have a dot here. So if it's a time-independent shift, we are allowed to make this change, and this is the gauge symmetry that comes with this new degree of freedom.
What do you mean gauge symmetry? It looks to me that this is like a Stueckelberg field.
Yeah, I mean gauge in the sense, but it is indeed like a Stueckelberg field. Yeah, I mean, we called it a gauge symmetry, but I agree with you. So,
question. Wow.
Okay. So now we can go back and look at the generators again. So BMS is again the same as before. Supersymmetric charge is now this horrendous thing, which has so many terms. It is these terms are also nonlinear in the fields. So it's a whole mess. And then we have this extra gauge or shift in the field of omega, which is associated with some very simple looking term. So not only do we get an infinite number of fermionic generators, which will act like the square root of supertranslations, we also have this extra symmetry. And together, they give us this capital S BMS for algebra. So the one that Awada Gibbons Shaw found, which has a BMS plus the usual four supersymmetries, that's normally called the SBMS algebra. So we called it capital SBMS. Now, this part is BMS as before. Here is exactly where we gained something. So earlier, this two supersymmetries would close only on ordinary supertranslations, so the four A0 and AIs. Now we get all the supertranslations on the right-hand side, and the bracket between the supersymmetry and this extra charge is just a central charge, and they are these Qs commute between each other. So effectively, what we get is that the supertranslation parameters we get from this bracket is a quadratic expression in these local supersymmetries. So we have found the square root of supertranslations for supergravity at spatial infinity. Now, there are some important properties of this algebra. First of all, we have this Q sigma symmetry, which is, well, we would be happy if it didn't appear in the theory, but it does. And you may think it's a bit unnecessary or redundant in some sense, but it actually plays a very important role when you try to check Jacobi identities. So we can't claim something is a symmetry unless we check all the Poisson brackets and also then that the Jacobi identity holds for everything. Now, since there are nonlinear terms in the generator here, when we check the bracket of, let's say I take this bracket and I check the Jacobi with a boost, it's going to be a mess and it doesn't close properly unless I use this Q sigma charge. So this does play an important role in the whole algebra as such. So we can't just ignore this extra tower of symmetries. And it's only with all of these charges that we can define a good algebra, asymptotic symmetry algebra for n equals 1 supergravity. Now, we can go back to the question that Laurent just asked. When exactly do we need a boundary degree of freedom, or can we always add a boundary degree of freedom and get more and more symmetries, which is something reasonable to ask, because this is exactly how we get these rich, interesting symmetries at null infinity. And there are many examples at spatial infinity where you can see that these boundary degrees of freedom are required. So, for example, spin one. If you look at electromagnetism, you must always include a boundary degree of freedom in order to get make the boost canonical. The problem is always the same. You relax the boundary conditions, and the boost charges are no longer canonical. And in order to restore the invariance under boost, you have to add something at the boundary for the spin one case. It's also the same for Einstein-Maxwell, electromagnetism in higher dimensions, duality invariant formulations. So this seems to be a pattern that spin one always needs a boundary degree of freedom at spatial infinity. Spin two, on the other hand, does not. You can do it for the whole theory or polyfields. So you can just look at linearized gravity. Of course, the algebra is going to be the same, but even there, you can see that the boundary degree of freedom is not required. And even for five-dimensional BMS, it was shown recently that there is no need to include a boundary degree of freedom. Everything can be defined canonically for the Poincaré charges. For supergravity, we have two examples. We also looked at free spin 3/2, where the background is just Poincaré, and you have some angle-dependent fermionic gauge symmetries. But in that case as well, you have to add this omega-like boundary degree of freedom, and for supergravity, of course. So the question is there a pattern, or can we come up with some unifying framework where maybe we understand this better? So, yes, please.
Isn't this rather a statement about boundary conditions? I mean, I can take a spin one without these extra boundary degrees of freedom if I just put stronger boundary conditions.
Yes, but then you don't get the U1.
No, I agree. But then maybe the problem is that in U2, we just didn't hook up the right boundary condition to source some boundary degrees of freedom. So when you say boundary degrees of freedom, not required.
Not required for super translations, I agree.
For super translations. Okay, that's the statement. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So for super rotations, we thought that one naive approach would be, so at some point we set this lambda a to zero. Sorry. Okay. So we had this, which goes like this 1/r dot dot dot. So to cure the problem with the boost, we put this to zero. So we thought, okay, maybe if we turn this back on, and some there is some other way in which the canonic boost charges may be well defined, then we get super translations. But the problem seems to be worse, because if you keep this, then it also affects the other charges, like time translation, and there are contributions in the bulk, which you can't cure by surface terms. it seems a bit hard to solve this problem, but there are some attempts, very recent and maybe a bit premature to say this, but maybe if you include log terms here, that could be a bit way out. This is something that people are working on, like Oscar. I don't know the current status of it, but
concerning super rotation, so I recommend, because we've looked at that with Adria and
yes, yeah, please.
In Vienna, and we've just relaxed the component HAB.
Yeah.
Like at nil infinity, or like the transverse part of the boundary metric. So this is what we did at space like infinity.
So you mean, so it goes like this, let's say.
Yes.
This is the
metric of the two sphere. You can just take an arbitrary metric.
Mm-hmm.
And it works like.
You mean instead of the this usual one and sine squared theta, you have something.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, yes.
But then you have to go to the renormalization.
Yes, so in that case, you're saying one can add something at the boundary.
Yes, it works a bit differently for the renormalization.
Sure, I mean.
The component of the symplectic structure that is not the same, but.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what I'm saying. There may be some even bigger structures which we are missing, but at least for the very nominal BMS super translations, we don't need to add something. The boundary conditions defined by Reggie-Teitelbaum plus the gauge twist defined by Henner-Trossart are enough for super translations. Okay. And then
this is something I
maybe started appreciating last week after Cassia's talk, that maybe a good place to look at would be some BV, BFV formulation, because it's really a robust framework where the notion of symmetry really lies on the Hamiltonian or symplectic structure of the manifold, and you can define charges, or you can even define how you can see how one can change the symplectic form by adding boundary terms or even corner terms. So I think this is something we should appreciate more. I mean, meaning people who are looking at spatial infinity. Maybe this is a way to connect this story to the covariance phase space or null infinity picture where we have corner modes and we always do this renormalized symplectic action form and we get this nice, rich and infinite dimensional symmetries. So this may be something that we should take more seriously. Yes, please.
Yeah, I have a question in the chat. If you looked at the Clara supergravity case.
Not yet, no. But
I think it would help.
We have only looked at the minimal case.
If you looked at the chiral supergravity case, it would help. Because you then have a gauge symmetry of O1, 2.
Why don't you fix the problem?
Have you connected with the surfaces?
That's not my computer, it's not strong.
It's just a computer.
No, it's not. My computer is not strong. It's the room.
Is the room strong?
Yeah.
No, okay.
Can I try one?
Yeah, please.
Sorry, French. It's not the problem. It's not. You find something in the machine.
Could he type the question?
Type the question, but I think, yeah, you can continue.
Okay, I mean, I'm almost done. So this is probably the 150 minutes, right? Yeah. So, as I tried to explain in the talk, that this is just the beginning of the story, how we can understand asymptotic symmetry algebras at spatial infinity, because we have just started with super translations. There is a long way to go. And one of the key motivations would be to understand the connections to null infinity results, because that's something that has been explored quite extensively. We have celestial holography or some candidates for flat space holography, and there is a whole wealth of literature on scattering amplitudes, soft theorems, how these symmetries are connected with these soft theorems. And one important point is that the parity conditions at spatial infinity are actually very closely related to the antibodal mapping we have to do at null infinity. So this is probably one of the main points that we need to understand if we want to connect the story at spatial infinity, because if you look at the Penrose diagram, you have an I-naught here, it's chi plus. So it's really like you're approaching the celestial sphere here. You blow this up, it's like a celestial sphere. And how you map the past of chi plus with the future of chi minus is very closely related to how we impose the parity conditions on the fields which lie on this two sphere. So maybe if you manage to do that, there could be some more insights into how to recover super rotations, DFS2 and the other extensions at spatial infinity. Then, of course, there is another very important part that we have to understand well, is the group theoretic interpretation of these different symmetries. Now, there is a comment about the nonlinear structure of super BMS algebra, that it was recently noticed in this work that BMS5, so the asymptotic symmetry for five-dimensional gravity, also has these nonlinear brackets, and the bracket of two boost symmetries is actually quite complicated, and it involves some nonlinearities. So it may not be just an artifact of our way of defining charges. There could be something, some very rich structures that we can understand from this Hamiltonian approach. And then there is something that I would really like to understand, which is the infinite dimensional representations of Lorentz group. So there are some very old works, mainly by mathematicians, where they have commented on some infinite dimensional representations irreducible representations of Lorentz group, and the idea would be to see these square roots of supertranslations that we claim that the local supersymmetries act as square roots of supertranslation. Can we see this at the level of group theory, so or at the level of representation theory? So there are ways to define irreps of Lorentz group for vector and spinner representations. So what happens if I take the tensor product of two spinner representations? Can I get an infinite dimensional vector representation, something like that? Then in that sense, it would be truly the square root of supertranslations in our case. And then, of course, there is some more ambitious goals, which is to extend the this analysis for supersymmetric theories with extended supersymmetry, for example, n greater than 1, n equals 4, or n equals 8. And the reason is the following. These extended supergravity theories often have very interesting exceptional symmetric groups. And these exceptional symmetric groups actually, their foundation lies in the duality symmetry, electromagnetic duality symmetries of the vector fields involved. So it would also be interesting to look at duality invariant formulation of GR, which is something we are trying to understand. And maybe let's say the n equals 8 supergravity theory, which has four loop, which is finite to four loops, has this nice E7 symmetries. And it has been shown that these E7 symmetry, one can see the signatures of this E7 symmetries in the double soft limit of scalars. And we know that asymptotic symmetries are also very closely related to soft theorems. So is there a way we can relate this kind of symmetries with the infinite dimensional asymptotic symmetries or not? And what would be the infrared triangle that mainly people at null infinity they like to see for asymptotic symmetries? What would be the analog of that for supergravity and so on? But these are more ambitious goals, I guess. But I think that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Can we just pass on you like these comments?
So yes, please.
I wanted to say that the Carrel supergravity in the Carrel supergravity, the SU2L gets symmetry extended to OSP12, and that the Bonnery theory is transformer theory of S2,1 connection. And that was related to this comment about the Carrel supergravity case.
Yeah, I mean, that would really be an interesting theory to work with. This was just our very first attempt to include fermions in this analysis of asymptotic symmetries. But of course, it would be more interesting to look at theories where the boundary theory, maybe a good dual theory is known at the boundaries, and that can give us some clues about how to get more interesting symmetries like super rotations and so on. So thank you for the comment.
Good. Now I'm going to turn to students if there is any question.
Oh,
yes, please.
So, I mean, first, so this isn't exactly 100% related, but if you take gravity in 4D, and then there's the story of Strominger and others that says that you should have Fiorisoro on the celestial sphere, is that
correct?
Okay. So, from your perspective, if you have 4D n equals 1 supergravity, do you get super Fiorisoro on the celestial sphere in this usual sense, or...?
Maybe at null infinity, but because we still haven't been able to show that the Virasoro that you're talking about exists for gravity itself at spatial infinity, because this is really built up on the super rotations. As I said, we have only managed to find super translations. So the first problem to solve would be how to include super rotations, because in that case, we will have this Virasoro symmetry at spatial infinity as well. And then the hope would be that this can be extended to a graded version, which is super Virasoro.
Okay, so at null infinity, there's no obstruction to
any. I think so.
And this super Virasoro symmetry would, I mean, do you lose any super symmetry? Because in 4D n equals 1, you should have, I guess, four supercharges. So if you
yeah.
N equals 2, 2, the super Virasoro, like, do you get one?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
N equals 2, 2 supersymmetry in 2D.
In 2D?
Yeah.
In 2D, I don't really know because we have...
Because you should solve for supertensions, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can, of course, do the same analysis for lower dimensional theories and even 3D, let's say. So are you talking about dimensional? So if I start with N equals 1 in 4D and I reduce it to lower dimensions, are you asking about that?
Well, I mean, I know if you compactify circles that you'll definitely not
yes.
break anything. But I'm asking specifically about this context because I don't know anything about it. That's why. I mean, I'm asking, do you, in some sense, lose supersymmetry at all when you go down to something like the celestial sphere or go to...
In fact, we would like to get more supersymmetries, and this is what happens in the bulk of the theory. You have only the usual supersymmetries, but when you go to the celestial sphere, you get an infinite tower of symmetry, the supersymmetries.
I see. So it really is like okay.
Yeah, but again, there is another interesting question: what happens if you take this theory and reduce to lower dimensions? And that's a bit complicated, I think, because one has to be careful about the conformal structure at infinity. So, here, for 4 dimensions, it's a sphere. But if you do this for 3 dimensions, it's an S1. So how do we go from S2 to S1? And if all the solutions are included, or you have to focus on a subset of solutions, these kind of questions have to be addressed.
Last question is if not, I think we can transition again to our
thank you.